It starts with you and me. It starts with you and me. We all can be heroes if we take the lead to change the bad to good, to live in harmony. It starts with you and me. Have to teach the children about living with each other, 'cause the future will soon be in their hands. Watching us close, they follow our steps. If we do right, I'm sure they'll understand.
Hello, and welcome to Spingola and Friends. It is Monday, November 17th, 2014. This is Deanna Spingola. This radio program does not have any corporate sponsors. Therefore, we are free to discuss controversial topics that are not politically correct and those you might not hear about on other programs. My website is spingola.com. There you will find information about my three books, The Ruling Elite series, as well as a timeline of book 2 and 3. I really love timelines. I think that they kind of connect things together. You can look in one particular year and see all of these events that happened, and you know that they happened because they were all designed and orchestrated to happen at the same time. Please also visit the website of a friend and listener who has created and maintains the website, SpingolaSpeaks.wordpress.com. All of the more recent audio files of my programs are at that site, including the RBN audio files and the American Free Press files. My Twitter account is twitter.com/DeannaSpingola. And I've entitled this particular program today, Do You Have a Fiction Addiction? And that term was supplied to me by a listener and friend, and I just thought that is such a perfect term. I just have to use that in some way, and I believe it's very relevant, and I do believe that a lot of people do have addictions to fiction. Now, I've just also finished another book that will be going to the printer, publisher today, and the name of that book is called Screening Sandy Hook, Causes and Consequences. In that book, I've used a term called Key Opinion Leaders, which are KOLs. Now, I have a cold, I'm sorry. Excuse me. So, thank goodness for the mute button, and I probably will have to use it frequently today. So I do hope that I will have callers so that I don't so that I don't spend most of my time talking, because I see that it'd be kind of taxing. Anyway, in the pharmaceutical industry, key opinion leaders are physicians who influence their peers' medical practice, including but not limited to prescribing behavior. And they are, the pharmaceutical companies generally engage key opinion leaders, KOLs, early in the drug development process to provide advocacy activity and key marketing feedback. Often KOLs are chosen more for their high prescribing habits than for their knowledge or other attributes that would enable them to influence their peers. Physicians are more interested in true thought leaders who have credentials such as academic standing and have performed clinical trials. Pharmaceutical companies hire KOLs to consult for them, to give lectures, to conduct clinical trials, and occasionally, more frequent than not, to make presentations on their behalf at regulatory meetings and hearings. At Wikipedia, which I will go to right now, at Wikipedia, It states, opinion leadership is leadership by an active media user who interprets the meaning of media messages or content for lower-end media users. Typically, the opinion leader is held in high esteem by those who accept his or her opinions. Opinion leadership comes from the theory of a two-step flow of communication propounded by Paul Lazarsfeld and Elihu Katz. Significant developers of the theory have been Robert K. Merton, C. Wright Mills, who wrote a fascinating book, and Bernard Berelson. This theory is one of several models that try to explain the diffusion of innovations, ideas, or commercial products. Now, in the alternative media, KOLs are people who express their values, and they are often referred to as facilitators or as provocateurs. Getting back to the world of medicine, a key opinion leader is a somewhat Orwellian term used to describe the senior doctors who help drug companies to sell drugs. And key opinion leaders in the alternative media are either they do it because they like the popularity, or I have no idea why they do it. But these influential people are prevalent in the alternative media, and they give out their opinions. And key opinion leaders are actually salespeople. They are selling ideas, and they are regularly sought out by their colleagues for opinions or advice. They often speak at regional or national conferences. They might publish articles. They might consider themselves, they're probably the first to break the news about an event or to establish their opinions about a particular event. And they help to establish opinions for the rest of us to embrace. Now, in the areas of life, these influence peddlers, as I mentioned, are called facilitators or provocateurs, and they seek to have others embrace their opinions without any scientific or verifiable facts. Well, they want people to think that what they are spreading is the truth. Excuse me. When in fact, it is simply their opinion. And now, the Delphi technique, which is something that they often use, was developed by the RAND Corporation for the United States Department of Defense back in the 1950s. It was originally intended for use as a psychological weapon during the Cold War. However, it was soon recognized that the steps of the Delphi technique could be very valuable in manipulating any meeting or any group of people, like the people in the alternative media, toward predetermined conclusions. Now remember, there is opinion, and then there is truth. And I think that we can all relate to that. I mean, a lot of us believe that there were, that at one point in time, that the Germans killed 6 million Jews. Although there was no scientific evidence, there were never 6 million Jews under the jurisdiction of the Germans at any one time. The scientific data that has come forth after World War II absolutely proves that this did not happen. Yet, millions of people, despite all this scientific evidence, still believe that the Germans murdered 6 million people. Many people, while embracing relatively diets, maybe even being vegetarian or really being concerned about taking care of their kids, will take their children to get vaccinated. And there's no scientific basis for vaccines. I mean, seriously, when you think about it, why would any parent take their child to the doctor to get a shot filled with mercury in the form of thimerosal, which is still in the flu shot, aluminum, DNA from pigs, sheep, cows, aborted fetal tissue, I mean, and live viruses. I mean, that's absolutely ridiculous. And yet, millions of people do that, not based on any scientific evidence, but because they think that that is what they should do, based on opinion, which was, from the pharmaceutical industry. And what about those mammograms? Now, yesterday, my second guest for my RBN program, Judith Ferry Baker, said that she, early on, had developed she was able to produce cancer using radiation. And one of the things that she said that kind of struck me, and I have to re-listen to this and make sure that I got this right, but from what I understand, she said that she had developed this way, and she said that if you could radiate something from the bottom and the top, that it would be more effective in introducing cancer. And right after she said that, I thought, and she said that she had no idea that what her superiors were asking her to do was to develop a biological weapon to use. And so I was thinking, let's see, mammograms. You take a woman's breast, you mash it between two steel plates, and you shoot it with radiation from both sides. Now, doctors in medical school, students in medical school, are told that when they are examining a woman's breast, that they are to be very, very careful lest they break a cyst or something else. And yet, millions of people, women over a certain age, are instructed or recommended that they go and get a yearly mammogram. That's ridiculous. We're told to stay away from radiation, but you're going to take the most sensitive area, the most sensitive part of your body, vulnerable, and let some technician shoot it with radiation. And the radiation that you receive, just like in a CAT scan, is just like 100 times more radiation than a chest X-ray. Okay, we're also told, based on the nonsense that is in the diagnostic and statistics manual, the DSM, that there is such a thing as a chemical imbalance in the brain that causes depression. And thousands of people believe this, and so they accept an SSRI, which then proceeds to cause a chemical imbalance in the brain. We've been led to believe that soy is healthy, and if you've read the book or listened to Kayla Daniels, who I've had on the program numerous times, it is one of the worst products that you can possibly put in your body. We have also been told that Hitler started World War II with a false flag event at Gleiwitz. We've also been told that he was a sexual deviant, and just all kinds of nonsense, absolute nonsense. And we've heard about this, I hate to say it, but we've heard people in the alternative media spread this nonsense about Hitler and about the NSDAP. In fact, it's spread by some of the so-called leaders, the KOLs, if you will, in the alternative media. In letters to the editor in the Barnes Review, which is the Journal of Nationalist Thought and History, on page 62, it says it's a letter from Sean Anderson in Hawaii. And this person states, "For some time now, I've been reading your articles about Hitler and gaining a totally new understanding. Contrary to what I have believed over the years, I've developed a respect for his intellect, his reasons for his actions, his respect for women, and the respect of many towards him. Those stories having him wild-eyed and raving, chewing the legs of chairs, went out the window. Yesterday, I was rereading a book entitled The New World Order Exposed, and the author, who I do have some of his books, I don't have this one, but he did do a good job on the one that he wrote about the Holocaust. Victor Thorne says he depicts Hitler as a drug addict with bizarre sexual appetites, a reincarnated black magician who obsessed over women defecating and urinating on him. And one begins to see that what a truly deranged and twisted little man he really was," unquote. Well, this whole story came from the Americans. The OSS created these stories as soon as Hitler became chancellor in 1933. The OSS and other groups went to work trying to discredit him. And I've covered this quite a bit in my third book. But anyway, the writer goes on to say, "Victor Thorne has been one of my favorite authors. However, this rereading has stopped me dead in my tracks. His picture is totally at odds. I appreciate able to give me the honest picture. Thank you." And the editor writes, "Thanks for your letter. Victor is an excellent researcher, but many people, even one as astute as Victor, has been misled about Hitler. At TBR, we do not demand that all of our writers march in lockstep on all issues. We stick by our portrayal of Adolf Hitler and assure you we are right." And certainly, I agree with their response. Now, one of the chapters, in the last chapter in my book that is going to the publisher today, is entitled, and the name of that book is Screening Sandy Hook, Causes and Consequences. And the chapter, the last chapter, is called Consensus Plus Marketing Equals Belief. In other words, if you can get a small group of people to have a consensus, to reach an agreement on a particular topic, such as vaccines. If you can get 10 people at the FDA to approve of Gardasil, and then you can go out and market Gardasil to every television station, then pretty soon you're going to have a bunch of gullible people believing that they need to take their children, their daughters, and their sons to the doctor to get them vaccinated for something, that probably would never happen to one in a million people. Now, just because something is widely believed does not make it true. Now, Hitler referred to the big lie in his book, Mein Kampf. He was not talking about the big lie that Germany would use. He was referring to a certain ethnic group who repeat lies to the point that people willingly believe what they are being told. There are those who believe those lies and then temporarily leave the groupthink herd mentality comfort zone and reevaluate what they believe about a certain topic, only to return to the herd for fear of criticism or loss of approval. They lack trust in their own abilities to critically think. They are like today's students who rhetorically regurgitate what the teacher has presented in order to get an A, which is apparently more important than the truth. For years, I engaged in genealogical research. Now, this is important. People involved in any kind of research, to be accurate and therefore credible, whether you're searching family history or whatever kind of research you are engaged in, you must learn how to read official records, which include vital records, which would include birth, death, marriage, and divorce records. There's court records, probate records, estate tax, voters' registrations, church, census, land, passenger lists, and educational and group affiliation records. These are all primary sources. Now, the primary sources are the records that a researcher should access first, because such records were created at the time or very close to the time of the event. Now, official records are primary sources. Okay? Now, secondary sources would include books, databases, newspapers, indexes, such as a census index, and data that individuals, often paid employees, have put together, often without any verifiable sources. These sources often contain simple human errors. We all make them. Researchers also have to gain an understanding of which jurisdiction has custody of the specific record. For instance, counties, as soon as they were created, devised and had jurisdiction of marriage licenses. Later, some states assumed control of marriage records. Jurisdiction also depends on the state. New England states initially created records on a town rather than a county basis. Now, one would not visit a state library to find vital records, and most certainly should not expect to find recent vital records such as birth, death, and marriage records on the internet due to privacy laws. Now, I have watched videos and just laughed my butt off when people have said, I could not find the birth records for those 20 kids that supposedly died at Sandy Hook, therefore they didn't exist. And I think that this person is an absolute idiot. But you know what? People believe that video. It is absolutely amazing. Now, I mentioned that there are two kinds of sources, the primary or original, and secondary or compiled. Now, remember, primary records are records that were created at the time of the event. Secondary sources are typically compiled, which are frequently based on hearsay or circumstantial evidence. Government records are typically the primary sources. So, whether you like the government or not, they do create most of the primary sources. And this is very, very important. Every researcher, whether you're online, writing a book, or whatever, every researcher should cite their sources, so that others might verify or access the very, very same information. Now, I have a lot of footnotes in my books. Doesn't mean I don't make mistakes. In fact, recently I got an email saying, you know, Stalin did not attend that meeting, and you say in your book that he did. Oh my gosh, he's right. The emailer was right. Stalin did not attend that meeting because of the war. I made a mistake. It's what we do. Humans make mistakes. But we also learn from them. When people correct me, I accept the correction and I'm happy to know that I can correct it. I mean, it's just humans make mistakes. I've never read a book where I have not found a mistake, honestly. So currently, one of the biggest collections of secondary sources include compiled data on the internet, some of which is presented by unknown entities and some by people who identify themselves. Researchers should always use primary sources when they compile any kind of written account of any event. If one just compiles and presents a lot of information without citing specific sources or viewing any official records, then that person certainly cannot completely interpret an event. And it is important, because if somebody cites a source, they can misrepresent that source. And I'm going to give you some examples of this. Now, keep in mind, remember, there are two kinds of sources, primary and or original, and secondary or compiled. Keep that in mind on any kind of research that you're doing. And keep in mind also there's a difference between disinformation and misinformation. Disinformation is deliberate, subtle, insidious propaganda frequently integrated with truth, especially in the so-called truth movement. Misinformation may be a simple demonstration of ignorance or human error. We are unequally educated. Some people do not read, but rather they draw their conclusions from media sound bites, YouTube videos, or from their like-minded association with others. Unfortunately, integrated misinformation is prevalent in the truth movement environment, where susceptible people apparently accept perpetual legends that scholarly investigators have thoroughly invalidated. An author, a radio host, such as Victor Thorne, or a guest might present factual information 90% of the time. It is the 10% that we have to worry about. We cannot judge a person's intentions, whether the misinformation is intentional or not, but we can often see the influence that that information has. Now, when I first started writing articles for various websites in 2005, I promulgated some some popular theories because of my ignorance. I cringe when I read some of those early efforts. I could cleanse my own archives, but it would be like trying to capture feathers in a whirlwind because my articles are on other websites. And unfortunately, I can't call them back. I used to think that Hitler was, he was a poster child for evil, poster guy for evil. He was the most evil person on the face of the planet. And I believe that. But I also believed in being objective and in looking at both sides, which I came to do. And if anybody is doing research, that's what they're going to do. They are not, they want to look at both sides. You need to be objective in your research. And you need to ask yourself the following questions. Where did the information come from? Is it well sourced? If you find information on the internet and there's no sources and you can't find the original source, well, then it's questionable. Number two, what is the background of the author? Is this author well known? What's he do? Is he using his real name? And I understand that for occupational reasons that there are a lot of people who cannot use their real name because they have a family to support, so they use a false name, a pseudonym, to save their occupation. I understand that totally. I use my correct name because I'm not in that situation. Is the person adamantly promoting a particular theory in an effort to conceal the real culprits? And that is what I've covered in the book that I'm sending in today. Number four, is his or her book on the New York Times bestseller list? People make that list because the powers that be want to promote a certain theory. And always remember the 90-10 ratio. 90% truth does not make the questionable 10% factual. Now, on RBN, for 3.5 years, I talked about so many controversial things. I talked about Hitler. I talked about the Jews. I talked about the Holo-hoax. I mean, I spent a whole week in May of 2011. And the name of the week was Off Your Knees, Germany. And we spent the entire week on the Holo-hoax. And yes, I often heard about it, and it was okay. You expect criticism when you're talking about controversial ideas, but when I started to talk about Sandy Hook, all of a sudden, it might be just a coincidence, but you know what? Coincidences are rarely really coincidence. But when I started talking about Sandy Hook, I was quickly switched to a weekend program. And Ben Swan, who's a highly paid anchor, took over my program and think, wow, that's very interesting. He's also quite popular in some alternative media. He does a... some advertising in RBN, and he's quite popular. I'm sure he's a nice person. But with regard to Sandy Hook, much of what is on the internet was created before the official investigation was concluded. That is not to say that one should not ask questions about the official conclusions or about the things that were omitted from the investigation and the report. I have many questions. Professor Jonathan Gruber, an MIT economist, stated in the Daily Signal, and this is kind of relevant to what we're talking about, that the general public is ignorant and gullible, inasmuch as many people believe that the Affordable Care Act was a benefit when, in fact, it allows the federal government to further seize control over everyone's life via a public-private partnership designed to deprive people of all choices that should be personal and private. Gruber said that the government was able to pass this gigantic fraudulent legislation due to the stupidity, and I quote, the stupidity of the American voter, and that it was critical for the government to use deception and obfuscation to get that thing to pass. Now, using deception and obfuscation is not exclusive to the mainstream media, but thrives in the alternative media. So, who are the opinion leaders in the alternative media? Let me just check briefly. Do feel free to call, and you may call in at 646-787-1915. And if you have questions that you would like to email to me, you may do that at comment@spingola.com. comment@spingola.com. And of course, we invite you to visit our chat room. And our chat room is spingola.chatango.com. Okay, getting to who are the KOLs, and thank you. Somebody in the chat room said, Deanna, you are one of the few who do admit mistakes, unfortunately. Well, because that's what you should do. I'm hoping the volume's okay. I know that Blog Talk Radio does have some volume issues, so hopefully the volume is okay. All righty. who are the opinion leaders in the alternative media? Unfortunately, they don't wear a uniform. They don't have any kind of badge that says, I am a KOL. They don't belong to a union. You can't identify them by sight. Opinion leaders are anyone who has an active voice in any community. It's someone who speaks out and gets asked for a lot of advice. Now, I have covered the Delphi technique when I've talked about, when I've had the guest on my program, Beverly Ekman, and her wonderful book, How to Counter Group Manipulation Tactics. And she says that building a consensus is quite easy, that it is easier to control a group than to control a single individual. And that is so, so true. Now, as I mentioned, in research, if one continues to work on a specific research problem, there is a natural progression if evidence exists. If one continues the research going from question to question, verifying each and every clue, finding supportive evidence, not just circumstantial evidence, he may establish a fact. Research, if done properly, is not static. They're not going to keep asking the same questions over and over. They're not going to keep promoting the same talking points over and over and over. Because anyone may post their opinions on the internet. People may post and promote nonsensical theories that many ignorant and or gullible people accept because they lack research skills themselves. And I'm not an expert at research. I spent a lot of time doing it. And I hope that I acquired some proficiency. Now, are some of the purported researchers, in quotes, actually cognitive infiltrators contributing to a virtual feeding frenzy now known as the Sandy Hook hoax? Alrighty, I'm going to now go to my manuscript and let me just kind of, I'm going to give you a couple of paragraphs out of the manuscript. Historically, some of the most skilled provocateurs have been teachers in the perception-shaping public schools and universities. Students regurgitate what the teacher has taught in order to obtain an A, which I already said. Most people want to please their teachers, authority figures, and following graduation, retain that mentality. They have the same reverence or respect for doctors and are quite willing to take a dangerous drug upon his or her recommendation, despite the risk, if that doctor says the benefits outweigh the risks. However, it is the patient who is taking all of the risks. Teachers should encourage independent learning. A good teacher does not teach, but encourages objective thinkers or students to learn not to regurgitate information that occurs when they use critical thinking about the information presented. Professional propagandists recognize that there is a limited amount of time to disinform the public before reliable researchers have access to the materials to scientifically and logically verify, invalidate, or challenge the official material. Now, when I, with that statement made, think about the time beginning in December of 1944, before Auschwitz was even liberated in quotes. They start talking about 6 million were murdered, 6 million were holocausted. So they literally had from even before, because they start talking about this following World War, before World War One, and so they had all this time following World War Two from December 1944 onward until about 1965. And then when you have the commission on the Holocaust, which they created in 1979, this commission decided that there was a Holocaust. They legitimized the Holocaust for the people in America. And they also used movies beginning in about 1965, I think, Sophie's Choice and all kinds of other movies. There was books that came out legitimizing it. They had a couple of decades to get people to believe in the Holocaust. And now people, even within the so-called alternative media, still promote and believe the Holocaust. They still promote all that stuff. So anyway, people recognize that there's limited time. Let me reread that statement. Professional propagandists recognize that there is a limited amount of time to disinform the public before reliable researchers have access to the materials to scientifically and logistically verify, invalidate, or challenge the official material. People habitually retain the first stories they hear, but rarely read any retractions. Just like the retractions on the sign at Auschwitz. At first it said, oh, there were 4 million, and now it's down to 1.5. And if you actually read the official reports, like from the Red Cross, there were like 38,000. I think the total amount was 73,000, and 38,000 of those people were Jewish that died at Auschwitz. Are you ever going to hear that anywhere? You can hear that. They're going to do a retraction on the nightly news. Not anytime soon. So, people cannot. Getting back to my manuscript. People habitually retain the first stories they hear, but rarely read any retractions. And people cannot legitimately challenge the official story until the official story becomes public. And so it is regrettable that the investigation regarding Sandy Hook took as long as it did. The timing of the release of the final report around Christmas seems significant. Certainly, it would have garnered more attention had the authorities released it sooner or even a few weeks later after the holidays when people were not so distracted. But purportedly, it took longer because the alleged shooter was dead and therefore there was not going to be a trial. However, a year is a long time and allows a lot of questions and skepticism to take root, not just in the alternative media, but it allowed that mentality to extend into the mainstream. But, and this isn't in my manuscript, if they had put the report out immediately, people would have said, oh, it was all pre-prepared, and so it was all a hoax because it came out immediately. So you're darned if you do, and you're darned if you don't. If they'd put it out immediately, it would have been a hoax. They put it out a year later, it was a hoax. Now, I have a chapter called Distracting People with Deceptive Details. The subtitle of this chapter is called Hoaxology 101. And when you're an author, well, at least I feel I can create words. I can make up words if I want to. And people can adopt them or whatever. I don't care, but I happen to like the word hoaxologist or hoaxology. Alrighty. A friend of mine often uses the expression a legend in his own mind, which is applicable in many situations. Typically, there is substantial evidence of one's expertise in any given area. For instance, Frank Lloyd Wright, the architect, designed more than 1,000 structures and completed 530 too, providing physical proof of his expertise. Another example is Dr. David Healy, who I've had on this program. He is a professor of psychiatry, a psychiatrist, a psychopharmacologist, a scientist, and author who has substantiated the correlation between antidepressants and suicide and the conflicts of interest between the pharmaceutical companies and academic medicine. His numerous books, articles, and expert witness testimony are evidence of his expertise. Neither of these individuals had to concoct credentials to validate their area of knowledge and skill. The evidence and the easily accessible, verifiable history of their expertise do not need magnification because it exists. It speaks for itself. One does not have to scour the internet to find evidence of their existence and expertise. On the other hand, if one claims to be an architect but has never designed an existing structure, or perhaps just one structure, or written some kind of treatise or on architectural design, then we might question his credentials and architectural expertise. If one claims to be a nationally known expert on guns, photography, healthcare, nutrition, school safety, or some other field, then there should be existing evidence of that expertise before an individual makes that claim. If one is nationally known, then someone in the nation should have heard of him. There should be a record of him as a speaker at a national convention, testifying at a hearing, a video of on TV, or a radio appearance prior to the time that he and his promoters begin extolling his expertise. There are those who have little visible recent experience, but become experts in the course of being promoted as experts. Such expertise increases with each public exposure, so that people, if they are astute, actually witness the subtle, creative construction of a nationally known expert. For the record, most people who claim expertise in a particular discipline rarely refer to themselves as such, but rather his work and or history actually demonstrates that proficiency and provides sufficient evidence. On the other hand, there are those who quickly emphasize their often dubious credentials, lest anyone forget just how important he is. However, respect and recognition are due to those who have legitimate qualifications and demonstrate them. For instance, if one claims to be a nationally recognized school safety and security expert and consultant, and has in the past worked in the area of law enforcement or school administration, or as a teacher, would or should fully understand jurisdictional procedures, what I talked about originally. For instance, someone with that background and experience would never approach a school board to inquire about FBI records. Speaking of the FBI, on September 24th, 2014, on the Alex Jones website, a writer claimed, and I quote, "Recently released FBI crime statistics curiously appear to show that no murders occurred in Newtown, Connecticut in 2012, unquote. Any individual with a law enforcement background and who has any familiarity with the events of December 14th would know that the Connecticut State Police assumed full responsibility for the investigation and reported its statistics to the FBI. The Newtown Police Department did not, N-O-T in capital letters, did not report the murder statistics because it did not, in capital letters, conduct the investigation. The individual who wrote the story, which went viral, failed to understand the reporting system. He failed to understand what I talked about earlier, that you go to the right source. You figure out the jurisdiction. But this author, this individual who wrote the story, which went viral, failed to understand the reporting system and looked at the wrong FBI statistics, which were in table number 11 and not in table number 8. We may assume or not that he made an honest mistake. On the other hand, a person with law enforcement experience would recognize that there was a jurisdictional distinction and could have, if honest, immediately corrected the distortion. Otherwise, it is easy to persuade an unsuspecting group of people to accept faulty figures that appear reliable from a notably dependable site like the FBI. The article included a link to the official FBI site, which uses the Voluntary Uniform Code Reporting System, the UCR. Table 8 gives various statistics for each and every city and town. According to that table for Connecticut, the total number of murders investigated by local authorities within each city, town was 102. If you go through, you just add them all up, which is what I did. I added them all up. All the cities and towns in Table 8 amounted to 102. The cities that experienced the most murders were Bridgeport, which experienced 22 murders, because, well, look at the population. The population of Bridgeport is 146,030 people. Hartford experienced 23 murders. Their population is 125,203. And New Haven had 17 murders. They have a population of 129,934. The majority of the towns, most of which have low population, experienced no murders, or maybe one. Now, Newtown's population, according to the FBI database, was 27,904. In another database, Connecticut's population for 2012 was, and we're talking the entire population for Connecticut, was 3,591,765. In yet another database, Connecticut Crime Rates 1960 to 2013 states that there were 32 murders presumably obtained from the Connecticut State Police. Now, there is a Table 8 for every single state. A researcher should determine the exact specifications of a database. Okay, if you're going to use a database, remember I said that they were compiled, they're secondary sources, and are therefore subject to interpretation and human error during the entry process. At the FBI site for Table 8, you have to know what's in a database. What are the stipulations for this database? So, at the FBI site for Table 8, clicking on the link Data Declaration provides this information, and I quote, "This table furnishes the volume of violent crime, which would include murder and non-negligent manslaughter, forcible rape, robbery, and aggravated assault, and property crime, which would be burglary, larceny, theft, and motor vehicle theft, as reported by city and town law enforcement agencies, listed alphabetically by state, that contributed data to the UCR program." Unquote. And then right under that it says, again, it states, in quotes, "The data used in creating this table were from all city and town law enforcement agencies submitting 12 months of complete offense data for 2012. Unquote. This means that Table 8 is the compiled information contributed by local authorities officials following their investigation of the crime of murder. Okay, on the page showing Table 8, if one clicks on the link up at the top, violent crime, it will take the visitor to the page where he may view all of the data tables. There you are going to select table number 11. And if you read the data declaration, to ascertain the specific information contained in that table for each state, it will say, and I quote, "This table provides the volume of violent crime, which would include murder, non-negligent homicide, forcible rape, robbery, and aggravated assault, and property crime, burglary, larceny, theft, and motor vehicle theft, as reported by state, tribal, and other law enforcement agencies." Okay, and this is according to the contributed data to the UCR program, unquote. Again, it reiterates, the data used in creating this table, table number 11, were from all state, tribal, and other law enforcement agencies submitting 12 months of complete offense data for 2012, unquote. So, on the table for on the page for table 11, if you select Connecticut, which provides the murder statistics that the Connecticut State Police reported, it investigated 36 murders, which includes those in Newtown. The author of the story at Alex Jones' site mentions that 29 deaths were listed in Table 8 format for the city of Aurora, Colorado, likely included those occurring at the Century Aurora, and this is me talking, writing, likely those that occurred at the Century Aurora 16 Theater on July 20th, 2012. The shooter, James Egan Holmes, killed 12 people and injured 70 others. Okay, the difference between the shootings, see, he's trying to say, look, Table 8 set mentions the shootings at Aurora. Okay, so we're to believe Table 8 is accurate, but it doesn't include those at Newtown. So obviously, Newtown was a hoax, right? Okay, the difference between the shootings at Aurora and those in Newtown is that the local Aurora Police Department and the Arapahoe County Medical Examiner conducted the investigation, and not the Colorado State Police and the Colorado State Medical Examiner, as reflected in the FBI database. Now, Alex Jones confirmed the FBI site as being unusually accurate. He confirmed the accuracy of this site when he had a former Florida Highway Patrol officer on his program the next day promoting the idea that the FBI claimed that there were no deaths at Newtown. And they went on and talking about the hoax and how, gosh, at the fire department, all these people were walking around in circles, kept repeating the same stupid claims. Okay, the Connecticut State Police, and of course we know that they were walking around in circles because it was a loop video, okay? And they're still using it. They're still saying, yeah, they were just walking around in circles. It goes back to, if you repeat a lie enough, just like the ethnic group that Hitler was talking about, people are going to accept it as true. It doesn't matter if it's a big, fat lie. It's the repetitiveness. Okay, the Connecticut State Police published a 429-page book, Crime in Connecticut, January through December 2012, apparently a yearly endeavor. The total number of murders for the state, according to this book, is 143, with a note stating that the number included the Sandy Hook victims. This primary source gives the state's population, which is pretty close to the FBI site, as 3,590,333, as opposed to the other source, the FBI source, 3,591,765. And the population of Newtown as 26,389, as opposed to the figures shown in Table 8 of 27,904. Now, keep in mind that databases are, you know, it depends on exactly when the database was put together. But let me just tell you a funny little story. One time, we moved to a very small town. My family and I moved to a very small town in Wisconsin. And this town had 1,220 people. Or 12,000. Anyway, as soon as we moved to town, my daughter, sweet, sweet little girl, she said, "Mom, shouldn't they change the sign? Shouldn't they add us? I mean, seriously, Mom, they should add 4 to their sign." But that's just not the way it works. And that's not the way it works in databases. There's going to be some deviation from various databases. But anyway, so getting back to my manuscript, this is a very good book, this 429-page book. On page 245 of this Connecticut State Police book, under the heading Offense and Arrest Data, the number of murders in Newtown is 0 and refers to the footnote which states, does not include 27 victims of Newtown mass shooting. See State Police Miscellaneous. And this is consistent with the FBI tables, which also distinguish between the law enforcement jurisdictions and the reporting of homicides. They're very compatible in this respect. The point here is that people select and often manipulate or fabricate data to support a particular agenda. This person who created the article at Alex Jones, he just found the data to support his idea. Or he did it in ignorance. I have no idea. We don't know. We don't know his intentions. But we do know that it went viral and that people I think there was people that went all over the internet talking about it. And it's certainly now established that the FBI, that wonderful FBI, which has a very, very, very accurate site, according to Alex Jones, and it does. It is a very accurate site. Saying, well, if the FBI didn't report it, well, obviously it didn't happen. Okay, so people in the educational field should be very knowledgeable about the number of students within a public school system who are being prescribed psychiatric drugs. Probably the first thought that such a person would have in hearing about the events at Sandy Hook would be, what drugs Adam Lanz was taking, instead of asking about who ordered the porta-potties. Porta-potties were probably arranged by one of the many NGOs that swing into action for such catastrophic events. That same researcher claims that he was assigned as a response worker at the Columbine shooting in 1999. Thereafter, this researcher, in quotes, tried to raise money to free Mark Taylor, a Columbine survivor who had been forcibly hospitalized and given psych drugs. Taylor had been asking too many questions about the drugs that provoked the shootings and intuitively knew that they were the causal factor and testified to that fact in 2004. And thereafter, they put him away and started giving him a bunch of psych drugs. And this popular researcher in the alternative media knew about Mark Taylor's situation and tried to raise money to get this kid out of the psych ward. And so this researcher knows, being a former member of the educational system, the public school system, talked about autism. This person would know, would ask, what drug was Adam Lanza on? They wouldn't be saying, gosh, I wonder who ordered the porta potties. Okay, in 1998, Dr. Ronald D. Stevens, the executive director of the National School Safety Center, and that's NSSC, the executive director of the NSSC, developed a checklist of characteristics that should serve to alert school administrators, teachers, and support staff. A teacher, principal, or administrator should be familiar, and this is a quote, should be familiar with the following characteristics and might have applied them to Adam Lanza. Has a history of tantrums and uncontrollable angry outbursts. Is on the fringe of his or her peer group with few or no close friends. Is preoccupied with weapons, explosives, or other incendiary devices. Prefers TV shows, movies, or music expressing violent themes and acts. Prefers reading materials dealing with violent themes, rituals, and abuse. Reflects the dark side of life in school essays or writing projects. Is antisocial, on the fringe of peer acceptance. Is often depressed and or has significant mood swings. The NSSC created a 49-page document covering all media-reported school-associated deaths. Now, the NSSC is an organization that should be familiar to every teacher, every school administrator, every single school assistant principal, every girls volleyball coach, every school safety expert should be familiar with this 49-page document, which covers all school-associated deaths, beginning with the 1992 to 1993 school year to 2010. They issued this book on March 3rd, 2010. Certainly, teachers, principals, I'm sorry to reiterate this here, teachers, principals, and school safety experts would be aware of this report, which indicated that 348 people died as a result of shooting, while 67 died as a result of stabbings. 52 deaths occurred in elementary schools, while 311 deaths occurred in a high school. The greatest number of deaths, 93, occurred in California. Of these deaths, 88 were listed as suicide, 120 were listed as intrapersonal dispute, while those that involved a mass shooting, such as Columbine, were listed as unknown and totaled 165. It seems doubtful that any astute teacher, principal, or school safety expert would claim that the shootings mentioned above were staged 2 years in advance by the federal government or that the school and police authorities fail to adhere to emergency protocol. Like most folks who heard about these tragedies, he, she probably felt sorrow for the families and considered ways to make improvements at his or her school. Some people have challenged the way in which the first responders acted on December 14, 2012. These first responders were from the Newtown Police Department. The Newtown Police Department has probably not had a murder of a single person in how many years? I have no idea. If we look back in the books that the Connecticut State Police puts out every year, we would probably or look back in Table 8. There hasn't been a murder there for a long time. So anyway, some people have challenged the way in which the first responders acted on December 14, 2012. The Emergency Management Institute, FEMA, offers an online 3-hour introductory course on the National Incident Management System, the NIMS, without any prerequisites. This class was developed by the Department of Homeland Security and established in March of 2004. Anyone may freely complete this course. The DHS published a 13-page active shooter, booklet, Active Shooter, How to Respond, on page 6. It says, and I quote, "Law enforcement's purpose is to stop the active shooter as soon as possible. Officers will proceed directly to the area in which the last shots were heard," unquote. On page 5, it says, and I quote, "The first officers to arrive to the scene will not stop to help injured persons. Expect rescue teams comprised of additional officers and emergency medical personnel to follow the initial officers. These rescue teams will treat and remove any injured persons," unquote. People with law enforcement experience or who have any familiarity with the DHS, the Department of Homeland Security, and its methods on handling active shooters would not focus on inconsequential questions such as who served as the incident commander or why no one requested LifeStar helicopters. He probably would never claim that the authorities did not allow paramedics and EMTs inside the school, nor would he ask who declared the victims dead. He probably would not ask why the parents did not allow surgeons to extract and donate the organs of their dead children. Actually, vital organs are no longer viable once a donor is dead. Officials did not order Star helicopters because there was no life, an issue that Keith Johnson has thoroughly researched and has presented. It appears that some of the hoaxologists use a subtle tactic. If they burden or overwhelm sincere people with dozens of questions, then those who are really interested in the ramifications of Sandy Hook will spend valuable time refuting their claims and never have sufficient time to uncover the evil behind the real causes of violence, suicide, and mass murder. One hoaxologist, since the release of the official report, began posting messages discouraging people from looking at the report. The same person also misrepresented what some of the records say. People should investigate for themselves and draw their own conclusions. Those posts have strangely disappeared. The very first place that a person should look to discredit the official version of anything is the official records. People with integrity who are sincerely seeking answers readily accept evidence that addresses their issues, even if it contradicts their previous views or statements. Most people, when they make an error or a false statement, want correction as they are interested in the truth. People do not want to look ignorant. It takes a bit of humility to make adjustments, but that is what researchers do. They alter their views when confronted with new information that is based on evidence. However, KOLs, whose objective is to impose their key talking points upon a justifiably suspicious population, do not change their position, but keep repeating those questions. They ask questions or make definitive statements, not because they want information, but to generate a lack of confidence in public officials who frequently and regularly deserve our distrust and contempt. If people ask public officials for specific information that those officials have already provided in the formal report, then there is no need for further queries. If that information is the real objective, one might accusatorily suggest that the official reports associated with Sandy Hook are devised and deceptive. Then why ask for information from the very same people who conceived and ordered those reports if one fails to believe what is in the reports? I mean, it's just kind of ridiculous. If the inquirer is really seeking information, the reports are quite adequate and more than satisfactory. Therefore, we must presume that the objective is not really the acquisition of information, but the ever so subtle imposition of skepticism. Questions, unless they are legitimate, generate doubt, suspicion, and cynicism, and introduce disinformation. It seems that provocateurs are drumming up dissent, division, and distrust within the so-called truth movement. All righty. Let me just look in the chat room and see if there's some questions and check and see if I have any callers. Deanna, if you haven't already, could you speak about the combination of SSRIs given to children and the incessant playing of violin? Oh, gosh, yes. My whole book covers this. The whole thing covers this. Let me just check and see if we have any callers. If you want to make some comments or questions, feel free to call in at 646-787-1915. And let me just go back to another place in my manuscript where I cover something else that's, well, kind of interesting. Hang on just a sec. I need to backtrack a little tiny bit. And I'm going to talk about FEMA and their guidelines and the fact that a lot of people said, oh, Sandy Hook was a drill. And that is what they've said. But, well, just let me get backtrack. The book is, the manuscript is 344 pages long. As I mentioned, the name of the book is called Screening Sandy Hook, Causes and Consequences. Now, the reason that I use the word screening, because they've exploited this whole issue. They've exploited Sandy Hook. I'm talking about the government, has totally exploited Sandy Hook. And you would not believe all of the things that they have in place as a result of Sandy Hook. Yes, they did talk about the guns. There was a PSYOP for guns, but it goes far, far, far beyond that, far beyond the gun PSYOP situation. All righty. According to the FEMA guidelines, local school officials usually conduct drills on a closed campus where children are not present. Let me just get back into my chat room here. Okay, when is the book due out? Okay, it's just going to the printer today. They usually take 3 to 4 weeks. They will send me back I'm hoping to have it out a couple of weeks before Christmas. Hopefully it will be out before Christmas. But anyway. according to FEMA guidelines, and this is very important, according to FEMA guidelines, local school officials usually conduct drills on a closed campus when children are not present. Many school administrators also suggest that a drill is good experience for older high school age kids, but they would never consider exposing elementary age children to such a traumatic experience. In a drill, the participants must say at the beginning and end of every communication, "This is an exercise." There were no such communications or any actual evidence of a drill on December 14th, 2012. They also have to notify the community. They put a sign by the school or wherever the drill is being executed that there's a drill going on. Now, with regard to an MCI, a mass casualty incident, one researcher claims in an article dated October 8, 2014, and I don't mean to pick on people, but I'm demonstrating how these things get out of hand and why people believe the stuff they believe. Because KOLs put this garbage out and people believe it. Because these KOLs have influence. Okay. They put this... Okay. While FEMA and the DHS provide guidance on carrying agencies actually create and execute their own drill. In other words, the federal government is not going to say, "Hey, we're going to have a FEMA operation at this school. We're going to do this at this school." And they're not going to have what some people have referred to as a capstone event. They only have capstone events in one particular place. They have a town they've created that they only conduct capstone events at this particular town. And I'm not going to cover that in this radio program. Okay, so FEMA is not going to do an event. Only local agencies actually execute their own drill. Now, the researcher, in quotation marks, has a link purportedly showing this FEMA-generated plan, which, to be legitimate, should be external and not on the researcher's site. Okay? Remember, in the beginning of the program, I said that whether you're doing family history, whether you're doing genealogy, whatever kind of research you're doing, your resources should be easy enough that anybody should be able to find the exact thing that you're referring to. They should be able to go to that site and find the exact information that you have cited. They should, and their conclusions should be the same as yours. Okay, like the FBI conclusions for page 8. They just used this. They were right. Yeah, page 8 or table 8 said no deaths in Newtown. But they were citing the wrong thing. They wanted you to believe that there were no deaths in Newtown. They gave you a website to go to, but they were deceptive because they were pointing you to what they wanted you to believe, Alex and his author, or they were just ignorant, just really bad researchers. Okay? They gave you a site, but failed either deceptively or ignorantly failed to say, okay, this was just the information provided by local authorities. Okay, they didn't go far enough. Okay, so getting back to this other thing that just came out in October. So this researcher has a link purportedly showing this FEMA-generated plan, which to be legitimate should be external and not on the researcher's site. The plan is actually an MS document under Site Activation Call Down Exercise Plan, borrowed from the Massachusetts Health and Human Services, that someone has edited to convey that FEMA planned a special operation at Sandy Hook. School districts in Massachusetts may, and I'll post this in my chat room, I'll post these links in my chat room. They will be in my book, but okay. The school districts in Massachusetts may download and fill in the document according to their specific plans for a drill, something that many high schools conduct in numerous states. Each state develops their own plans. Whoever edited that document, also shown in a YouTube video published on October 7th, 2014, just a day before the article, wrote in the dates as above. In other words, they're going to have this drill, and they're going to have it an exercise date of December 14th, 2012. They wrote that in, okay? They wrote in the dates. They did this to deceive people into thinking that FEMA announced an exercise plan for Sandy Hook. According to our crack researcher, it explicitly references a scenario where the mass death of children at a school by firearms is followed by a suicide or apprehension of an unknown shooter. The researcher suggests that this might have something to do with the 11,000-page script that a former law enforcement officer claims was used by the Connecticut State Troopers. Now, Big Pharma and the AMA rely on a patient ignoring the package inserts on dangerous prescription drugs. Likewise, people who make such claims rely on their readers not to look at the sources they cite. I unsuccessfully attempted to find the original FEMA document that the researcher placed on his site. Whoever doctored the document provided the wrong email address for Thomas Romano, the regional trainer for Connecticut, by adding an E after gov. In other words, it was like Thomas Romano at something.gov, and he put an E so that if you clicked on that, you wouldn't be able to get a hold of him. He also, whoever doctored the document, he also was apparently insufficiently skilled, as he could not edit out the part that states all communications, written, radio, telephone, etc., made during the exercise will begin and end with the phrase, "This is a drill." Another site inevitably published the article regarding the so-called FEMA drill, and the link for the document again originates at the researcher's site. Now, if I, on my website, as an example, if I said, oh, I have found this document. Oh, it is so important. It shows what FEMA is going to do, or it shows that the government is going to do something at in Woodbridge, Illinois. I need to give a document that is on the FEMA website. Okay? If it's legitimate, it's going to be on the FEMA website. And my link on my website had better be a link to the FEMA website, not some document that I put on my website. That is so deceptive. I can't believe it. Okay. There was... let me just get back to my manuscript here. All righty. Whoever doctored the document said he also was apparently insufficient. Okay, I said insufficiently skilled because he couldn't edit out "this is a drill." Now, because remember, if that was a drill at Sandy Hook, they would have said "this is a drill." Every single communication, everything would have said "this is a drill." That didn't happen. There are audio files. There are radio communications. You can listen. Nobody said this is a drill. It wasn't a drill. Hello out there. It wasn't a drill. No drill. And this evidence is akin to the loop videos and the other discredited theories the hoaxologists try to foist on unwary truth seekers. When researchers, in quotation marks, resort to this kind of desperate proof, in quotation marks, one must question their integrity, their intelligence, their research skills, or all of the above. There was a school shooting drill in Bridgeport, 19 to 20 miles from Newtown, on December 14, 2012, from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. It was actually an all-day class conducted by the Connecticut Department of Energy Services and Public Protection, Emergency Management, and Homeland Security, entitled Planning for the Needs of Children in Disasters. Homeland Security issued the following directives regarding drills. Again, people, I quote, to prevent confusion with real-world communications or accidental deployment of resources, all communications must be clearly identified as exercise-related. This can be accomplished by displaying the phrase, exercise material only, quote, exercise material only, prominently on all typed or printed communications, and by beginning each verbal communication by stating, this is an exercise, or a similar statement as agreed upon by the exercise planning team. Okay? It wasn't a drill. It was the real deal, people. I mean, it did happen. Let me answer a couple questions. Does Deanna's new book cover the things the government has planned as a result of Sandy Hook? Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And it didn't start happening at Sandy Hook, after Sandy Hook. It started happening a few decades before. And I've documented it. Let me just go back to my manuscript. And I did share the names of some of my chapter titles yesterday when I thought my second guest was an hour late yesterday. She got the time confused because of the time differences. But anyway, I did talk about my book, and I hate to be self-promoting, but I am going to just go over some of the things. Let's see. I can't read my introduction because I don't want to get emotional. Okay, let me just go over the contents. I have several parts, and I had to start with some of the earlier things in order, some of the earlier things that the pharmaceutical industry and the allopathic industry have put into the into our paths. I had to do that because I always believe in background. You know, I mentioned before that I like timelines, and so we need kind of a starting place. And so I started with vaccines, and part one is vaccines, the primary assault. And I mentioned political protocols and the inoculation of disease. Now, that's kind of a title that, for those who are really astute, will note that the title refers to the protocols of the learned elders of Zion, or the lured elders of Zion. That is number 10 protocol, which talks about the inoculation of disease, which is, and that was, the protocols were written, well, they came out in 1908, thereabouts. And that is really when the inoculation of disease really was invented, was kind of started, although inoculations were used as early as Thomas Jefferson. But when they became common to the whole population was in the early 1900s, 1909, somewhere around there. Eliminating healthcare competition. Now, in order, that's my second title, my second chapter in this particular part one. Eliminating healthcare competition. You have to get rid of all the naturopaths. You have to close down all those teaching hospitals where they talk about natural ways of getting healthy. And then I talk about in Chapter 3 the contaminated polio vaccine. Chapter 4 is the National Childhood Vaccine Injury Act. Talk about the vaccine assaults against the military. And we know, of course, from programs I've done recently that there are 8,000 people in the military who commit suicide each and every year as a result of psychiatric drugs. Well, there's commonality. Let me go on. Anyway, I give the military vaccine schedule. It's amazing what they do to these people. Have a chapter, thimerosal, the Trojan horse of the psychopharmacological industry. Now, Adam Lanza early on had issues. He did not just turn into a murderer when he became 20. His issues go back a long, long way, probably within the year that he was born. I talk about mercury madness, autism, and autism spectrum disorders. Have a chapter on called Babies Engaging in Risky Behavior and the Hepatitis B Vaccine. Now, they designed this hepatitis B vaccine for people who were engaging in risky behavior, people who were sharing needles, people who were engaged in risky behavior such as gay people, homosexuals. But they didn't want to take this vaccine, and the companies that produced the hepatitis B vaccine didn't want to lose all that money, and because it would have been millions of dollars, because they couldn't encourage these guys to come in and get this vaccine. And so they convinced a consensus of people, convinced the doctors that babies should have this vaccine. And I explain how they did it, why they did it. And so you have have this vaccine developed for one group of people who refused to take it. And so they didn't want it to go to waste because, well, gosh, the FDA protects the pharmaceutical industry. And so they just start shooting babies with this stuff. Terrible. Terrible, terrible, terrible. And a lot of the babies received this vaccine before they even left the hospital, within 12 hours after being born. They had to get this vaccine. Now, Adam Lanza was born in New Hampshire. So I called the New Hampshire, the Health and Human Services in New Hampshire, and I asked about their policies in 1992. And their policies, they follow the policies that stated that they would just make certain that the vaccine was given within the first 6 months. So we know that this vaccine that was developed, I believe in 1991, that Adam Lanza got this vaccine. Now, his older brother didn't. His older brother was born in 1988. And in 1991, this is really significant. I find this very significant. There was, in 1991 and in 2003, the CDC substantially increased the amount of vaccines that people should get. In 1991, before the first invasion of Iraq, and right before the second invasion of Iraq. And I find that really, really odd. Really odd. Okay, my next chapter, Simpsonwood. Oh my gosh. Simpsonwood, Science by Consensus. Okay, this was a secret meeting that was convened, and I give the whole story about it, that was convened, and they decided that they would do a cover-up of the dangers of thimerosal. This is in 2001. That they had to get a meeting together. 52 people attended the meeting, many of which were from the CDC, because there were all these people were looking and finding out that the mercury, the thimerosal in vaccines, were really causing all this autism. They didn't want a bunch of lawsuits, and so they got all these people together, and they were trying there was a gentleman, a doctor, who created proof. They had proof that this was in fact what had happened, because he had gone through this database and found proof, and they had to cover up this proof. So they got this meeting together. And during this meeting, it was really kind of awful. There was one doctor who got a phone call from her son, or from his son, that his daughter-in-law just had a baby. And he said, oh, for gosh sakes, don't give that baby any shots. I don't want my grandson getting autism. And that was the condition of the people at the meeting. And there was one guy who attended the meeting from the World Health Organization. And what they did during this meeting was they had to come up with a cover-up to cover up this whole thing, so that nobody would be suing the government. Then after that, they hit the database that this one doctor used, Dr. V, I'm going to call him. I've got his name in the manuscript. They covered up his database. They then gave it to a private institution so that the regular public could not access it. In other words, nobody can access this database that this doctor used. This doctor then went to work for a pharmaceutical company that paid him big bucks, And the consensus was that the vaccines did not cause autism. And then they had the Institute of Medicine. My next chapter is the Institute of Medicine Damage Control, where they came out with more information that mercury, thimerosal, had absolutely nothing whatsoever to do with autism. Okay? But then a little later, they did go ahead and take thimerosal out of vaccines. However, they left in aluminum, they left in all the other garbage, the DNA from pigs, cows, sheep, aborted fetal tissue, antifreeze, hundreds of things which I have listed in the book. They left that all in there. And it is this group of people who seem to be vulnerable. These kids are the ones that develop ADHD, ADD. They have autism and autospectrum disorders. They are the perfect group for the psychopharmacological industry. They're the ones that are later going to get the SSRIs or the Ritalin when they get diagnosed at school as ADHD. And I think that honestly, given Adam Lanza's symptomology, he was probably on these kinds of drugs early on. Okay, going to the next part, the FDA, protecting the corporations. I talk about, let me give you the chapter headings. Pre-transformation of the FDA, commercialization of government-funded inventions. Excuse me. A lot of the inventions that the government funded were then turned over to private organizations, including universities and pharmaceutical companies. In other words, the taxpayer paid to create these inventions that then go to the pharmaceutical industry so that they can market them and make millions upon millions of dollars. I talk about the FDA Modernization Act of 1997, which states that children can now be used as guinea pigs by the allopathic medicine. They can be used in clinical trials. My next chapter is called Drugs for Tots, Pediatric Psychopharmacology. The next chapter is the FDA, Corporate Criminality. Next chapter is the Substandard of Care. Now, I have a funny feeling that when this book comes out and people have a look at it, the KOLs have a look at it, they're going to say, oh, well, we knew that. Oh, sure, we knew it was all about psych drugs. Yeah, we knew that. We were just kind of keeping it to ourselves. We didn't really want to spill the beans. Yeah, they really didn't want to spill the beans. This is all about getting every person in the United States on psych drugs. And I explain how it was done, who did it first, what state did it first. Okay, part three, the psych drugs, the secondary assault. Diagnosis by consensus. How did they develop? How did these psychiatrists develop their protocols? How did they develop all of these psychiatric disorders that we're all being diagnosed with? I mean, on their website, American Psychiatric Association, on their website, when they were developing one of their DSMs, they said, hey, anybody out there have some good disorders? Submit your disorder, and we'll think about it, and if it's good, we'll add it to our book. The next chapter, Prozac, a blockbuster of a killer. Next chapter, Prozac on Trial, 1991, where I talk about all these people that by 1991, now Prozac came out in January of 1988. It was tested on 286 people. That's it. 286 people were tested, did the trial run. They only had to accept two. It was stacked. 286 people. The real clinical trial is on anybody who takes Prozac. It's going on in the United States of America as we speak. Prozac, you are in, if you're on Prozac, you are in a clinical trial. I hope you live through it. I have a friend who was on Prozac for several years. Took her 6 years to get off. She got Bell's palsy. Doctor said, "Oh, I have no idea why you got that. It was a symptom, a side effect of Prozac." Her family, just from these side effects, after she got off Prozac, they convinced her that she needed to go and see the doctor. He put her on Abilify. Okay. And during this Prozac on trial in 1991, the CDC had a hearing where all these people, and there were already 200 lawsuits against Prozac. And so they had a trial, a hearing, and all these people who had family members that had committed suicide, including Dale Shannon. Dale Shannon committed suicide. He had been on Prozac for less than a week, and he committed suicide. They had all these people testify. They had 3 minutes to tell about their family member that committed suicide. And then they had the drug company representatives who said, "Oh, no, no, Prozac's great. It's wonderful." And guess what this consensus decided? They decided that, hey, there's nothing wrong with Prozac. It's really good for people. And I have the story. I went through the trial transcript. I went through the transcript for Simpson Wood. I've been through all these transcripts. I did my research for this book. I didn't look at some stupid YouTube video and say, "Oh, it was a hoax." No, I did my research. My next chapter, I'm so emotionally involved in this. I'm sorry, but I am emotionally involved in this issue. Chemical lobotomies for everyone. And that is what SSRI. It is a chemical lobotomy. Your mind will never be the same. They might say, "Oh, you have a chemical imbalance. Let us give you Prozac. You take Prozac, it will chemically change your synapses." And I have proof in this book from experts. I'm not an expert. I'm not a doctor. I've never played a doctor on television. I've gone to the experts. Okay, I have a chapter called Governor George W. Bush. What? His family has always made money off drugs. His family was making money off drugs way back in the 1800s. Well, things have not changed. What's my next chapter? What's good for Texas is good for the country. What they did in Texas is what they used for the rest of the country after. My next chapter says planting another Bush at the White House. George W. Bush got swept into the White House. And he immediately set up a commission. Commissions, conferences, advisory panels, they are all consensus. They are all designed to reach a predetermined conclusion. And I talk a lot about consensus in my book. Okay, so what they did in Texas they did for the whole entire country. My next subject, my next chapter, mental health screening, conduit for psych drug profits. Talk about screening. I talk a lot about screening, and the VA uses screening. It used to be that if you were on psych meds, you couldn't get into the military. Now the military uses mental health screening to get the military personnel onto psych drugs. 8,000 a year commit suicide. 50,000 people have committed suicide in the last two decades. According to Dr. David Healy, 50,000 people, 50,000 people have committed suicide as a result of psych drugs in the last two decades. And I talk about the 900,000 that die as a result of medications in the United States each and every year as a result of pharmaceutical drugs. Okay, breaking the taboo, drugging the military. I talk about why they do that. I talk about pill profiteering, checkbook science, and Madison Avenue Medicine. It is marketing, people. Marketing, marketing, marketing. We are running out of time. My next chapter, ask your doctor if suicide is right for you. I wasn't going to use that title, but I thought, you know, it's accurate. Because at the end of all those commercials, and they've been able to advertise since 1997, they say, ask your doctor if such and such is right for you. What they really need to be asking, or what they really need to be saying, is ask your doctor if suicide is right for you. Because you go on these SSRIs, and there's big, big chance that you will commit suicide. My next chapter is Kitty Cocaine for the Rambunctious Child. And we've talked about the Ritalin. It is a Schedule II drug. You get your kid on Ritalin. Next is the SSRIs. Next chapter, No Child Left Undrugged. They are drugging children under the age of 12 months. How does a doctor live with himself? How does he sleep at night if he prescribes an SSRI for a six-month-old baby? I talk about all this in this book. Sorry. This is a crime against humanity. What the psychiatric industry is doing is a crime against humanity. And I document it in this book. And those KOLs in the so-called truth movement are doing a great big, huge favor for the psych industry, because they would like nothing better than for that did not happen. And I explain how there is a collusion between the alternative media and the mainstream media. And part five talks about Operation Damage Control. Anyway, I cover it all. And people need to really do their own research and do your own. Don't believe what I tell you. If I can't prove it to you with real facts and real evidence that you can look up yourself and find in the right place, I don't want to be your KOL. Don't have a KOL. Do your own research, people. Okay, that's it for the day. Oh, I, I do have a caller. I'm sorry I didn't. Oh, darn. I'm sorry I didn't see the 708 caller. Anyway, email me. I should have looked at the screen, but I was just distracted. Anyway, thank you for joining me today. Thank you for putting up with my raspy voice. And thank you. Talk to you next week. Bye.
It starts with you and me.
To
change the bad to good.